If you could have a conversation with anyone in history, what would you ask them?
Hello, General Washington. Good day, Miss Tubman.
I had to know, so I decided, let's give him a call.
Welcome to the Calling History Podcast.
Welcome back to part two of Nathaniel Hawthorne. In the last episode, we talked about Hawthorne writing a biography that may have caused President Pierce to be elected, despite his numerous flaws. On a side note, Pierce is generally listed as our 40th best president. He also talked about Lincoln and how he was harshly critiqued after writing honestly about the president. In this episode, he'll expand further on his most productive time writing after getting married, the lucrative job that stifled his creativity again, and his relationship with Herman Melville. So what's the year right now and the day?
Today is actually the 4th of July. It's 1863. Today happens to be my birthday. And yes, we are squarely in the thick of the Civil War.
Well, happy birthday. And speaking of your birthday, I had heard once that you had told your sister-in-law that you didn't want to live to be 60 years old. Aren't you 59?
I am 59 today, yes.
And did you actually say that?
Well, I think Elizabeth has been gossiping a little bit. I did, in fact, just very recently say that to her as my birthday approached. I'll have to have a word with her after this discussion, but I think she may have taken me a little more literally or seriously than I meant it. As I mentioned to you earlier, I've been experiencing some health issues, some abdominal pain, which comes and goes, but it is quite taxing when it occurs, and some diminishing vision and just an overall weakness and fatigue. I'm realizing that I'm not nearly as young as I used to be. And I suppose rather offhandedly, I said to Elizabeth just the other day that I'm not sure I want to live to 60. And I suppose by that, I simply meant that if the body is going to continue to decline in this way, I certainly would not want to be a burden of any kind to my loved ones, my wife and my family. And so one might rather go out while they're still in working order.
Let's talk about the Scarlet Letter. The Scarlet Letter is read in nearly every school in the nation now. It is a very important piece of American literature. I guess I'm wondering what inspired that story?
As you may or may not know, certainly everyone in Salem, where I grew up, were aware of my history. My ancestors were all Puritans and not terribly kind Puritans at that. My great-great-great-grandfather actually came over with the first Puritans from England. He was on that famous ship, the Arbella, and he became a very prominent politician and judge in Salem. And I just find it so ironic that the Puritans came over for religious tolerance and then had none of their own for anyone outside of the Puritan religion.
Isn't that the way it works?
And worst of all, William Hawthorne, who was my great-great-great-grandfather. He was a terribly cruel man and was known to flog the Quakers in the streets of Salem, and terribly cruel man. His son, possibly even more cruel, his son John Hawthorne, was one of the major magistrates at the Salem witch trials, sent 19 innocent people to the gallows, saw many more die in prisons, saw one man crushed to death with stones, being tortured to give testimony. He became known as the Hanging Judge, John Hawthorne. These were some of my ancestors. And so, yes, I was terribly influenced in my writing by the tyranny in general of society, hypocrisy in general, the fact that the Puritans should flee from England because they were being persecuted and then carry on the same type of persecution themselves, to me, was perhaps the worst injustice that could be done. And so I wanted to write a story examining the moral hypocrisy of that kind of persecution. So the tale of the Scarlet Letter is about just that. It's about a woman who has a child out of wedlock. She believes she's a widow, and she has an affair with a local man and has a child. This is known as adultery to the Puritans, and so they force her to wear a scarlet embroidered A for adulteress upon her bodice, upon her clothing at all times, to be a living testament to her sin. What they really want is to shame her into revealing the identity of the father, which she refuses to do. So it's an examination of a woman who has a spirit that has no hypocrisy in her. She is willing to take on her own punishment and also protect the father of her child. Meanwhile, we examine all of these other people in the town, including her former husband, who is actually very much alive and shows up in the town, and they're all carrying around these secret sins, their own vanities, their own prejudices, and they are treating Hester, they're persecuting Hester while carrying their own secret sins within them. And so it was an examination of this hypocritical persecution that the Puritans of my ancestors and their contemporaries perpetrated.
The actual letter, the Scarlet Letter, what is your thinking behind that? Where did that come from?
Well, I think you're probably referring to the introduction that I wrote to the Scarlet Letter, which is a little sketch called The Custom House, wherein I sort of claim to, during my actual time serving as surveyor of the Salem Custom House, I go up into the attic of the building and I happen to rummage through some boxes and some papers there, and I find this scarlet embroidered A with a narrative of this woman, Hester Prynne, and all of the things that happened to her back in the Puritan age. And so I then claim to take these details and expand them into a larger narrative on behalf of the spirit of this wronged woman, Hester Prynne. Again, in my own personal fondness for ambiguity, I'm not going to claim that wasn't true. You'll just have to decide that for yourself.
I had read that, and I didn't understand this at all, but this first chapter about the customs house and finding the letter A, that for some reason there was something scandalous, or this was a significant chapter that made people want to read this book. What was it about that first chapter that was so significant to the people wanting to read this?
Well, as you may know, I was appointed to the Salem Custom House. It's a political appointment. And so I had some weighty political friends who were able to get me this fairly lucrative job as surveyor of the Salem Custom House. And it was certainly a lucrative job, but very damaging to my creativity. I did not write at all during my whole stay in that position. However, 3 years later, when the administration changed and the Democrats were voted out of office and Zachary Taylor, a Whig, was voted into the presidency, I very quickly lost that job, lost that political appointment. And so in what you might call a fit of disgruntledness, I wrote this rather sarcastic sketch lampooning many of the custom house officers who were all very well known politicians and officers to all of the citizens of Salem. And it was rather a scandalous treatment of these men who were generally revered. Of course, by all counts, it was satire. But I think a great many people in Salem wanted to read this rather scandalous account of these weighty citizens that everyone knew. And so it was actually a remarkable sale of the, in the first 10 days, we sold 2,500 copies of The Scarlet Letter. And it has been suggested that those sales were, as you say, in large part due to the introduction, the Custom House sketch.
You had said a minute ago that when you were working at the Customs House, that it was damaging to your writing. And as I've studied your life, it appears that there were lots of different times where you were trying to write or wanted to write, maybe wanted to do more writing than you were doing, but something got in the way. And then there is this period after you get married to your wife, Sophia, where it seemed like right after that, or right about that time, you put out some very important works, which included The Scarlet Letter and The Seven Gables. Is that true? Is that the time where you did your best writing?
There was a very prolific period of time right after my marriage to Sophia. Well, it wasn't directly after the marriage. We lived for 3 years in Concord in a house that we rented from Ralph Waldo Emerson's step-grandfather. It's all rather incestuous in Concord. But there was this very grand house called the Old Manse that was owned by the Emerson family, and they were kind enough to rent it to us for $100 a year. So we were able to live a very blissful first 3 years of our marriage at the Old Manse in Concord. And Sophia painted and I wrote and sometimes sold apples in town in order to earn a few extra pennies. It was during the stretch, right after the Custom House. Sophia was my savior in many moments of my life, but that time in particular when I lost my position at the Custom House, and we had three children at the time, and I did not know how we were going to move forward. And as it turns out, Sophia opened a drawer and pulled out a tremendous nest egg that she had secretly put away for the 3 years that I had worked at the Custom House and had created a sizable amount indeed that allowed me then for the next many months to simply stay at home and write. And it was that was the beginning of that prolific stretch of which you speak. The Scarlet Letter was finished within that same year. And then, as you say, the scandalous nature of the Custom House sketch was enough to decide that we might want to move out of Salem for a little while. So we moved to Lenox, Massachusetts, where I wrote my next romance, which was The House of the Seven Gables. And during that same time, I also wrote my first children's book, which was called A Wonder Book for Girls and Boys, which was a reimagining of many of the Greek myths of mythology. And I also began writing my third romance, which was the Blithedale romance, of which I spoke earlier, based on Brook Farm. So you're quite right. There was between 1850 and 1852, a very productive time for me, indeed.
It's a shame that you didn't have that $1,000 back from Brook Farm, because that would have bought you 10 years rent in that house. You could have just written.
That's a very good point. A very good point, indeed.
So the character, Hester's child in, is her name Pearl, is that right?
Pearl.
In The Scarlet Letter?
Yes.
Seems like a very important character, but I'm not sure why.
I think you may be referring to what many writers have intimated about the character of Pearl. She is a very kind of strange, mercurial child who one moment is sort of angelic and the next moment is very mischievous and says inappropriate things in public in the Puritan society and is unruly and then the next moment very loving. And she's just a very impish, mercurial child. And friends and other writers have speculated that Pearl was likely based upon my own first child, our daughter Una, who was very similar in character and nature.
Is that the truth?
Ambiguity.
You know, I asked that question knowing that there was no way that you were going to answer, but it's probably better that you don't. So what about, is it the House of Seven Gables? Is that what it's called?
The House of the Seven Gables.
I've been to that house. You never lived in that house. You didn't own that house, correct?
No, it was owned by the family of my second cousin, Susanna Ingersoll. But I visited her often over the years growing up. And Susanna used to lead me through the house and point out the changes in architecture through the history of the house. And this fascinated me. At the time that I visited her and that she lived there, there were only three gables left on the house. It had been renovated from the time that it was originally built. And it only had three gables at the time that we actually visited. But she brought me up to the garret, up to the attic, and showed me where the original beams that had supported all seven of the original gables. And this idea of a house that had so many of these grand gables captured my attention. And I started to mull over how that might play into a narrative.
Is this how the writing comes to you? Because looking at a couple stories, okay, so the Scarlet Letter, you explained your family's history, which, by the way, and I forgot to ask you about this, is that true that that's why you added a letter to your name to get away from your family history?
Much has been made of this speculation that before my adulthood, our family's name was spelled H-A-T-H, O-R-N-E. So it looks like it might have been pronounced Hathorn or Hathorn, but that somehow when I came of age, I added a W to the family name in order to distance myself from the guilt and shame I felt over my association with my ancestors. Now, I'd like to clarify that the name has always been pronounced Hawthorne. So it only looked in writing as if it might have been Hathorne or Hathorne. But it's always been pronounced Hawthorne. So there are three different explanations for why I might have changed that spelling. The first, as you say, is that guilt association with my ancestors. The second is that it's possible that I could simply have wanted to have it read the way it sounds, the way that it's actually pronounced. The third explanation is that there has been, during this last couple of decades, a new fashion to change the family name back to the original English spelling of the family name, which was initially with a W. So all three of those are completely logical reasons that could be offered. As a storyteller, the ancestor story is much more fun. So again, I will leave it to my readers to decide what my motivations were.
So the question I actually was asking, so you look at the Scarlet Letter and the inspiration comes from your family history. You go to the story Mosses from an Old Manse, okay? And there was the house that you lived in, I think, that was called Old Manse. And then you look at the House of the Seven Gables and the history of that. And you mentioned the Blithedale story, and that had to do with the commune that you were at. Mm. It seems clear that you're just walking around and noticing things or paying attention to what's going on in the world, and then you get inspired and your imagination creates some fantastic story, which leads me to the question, How did your friend Melville?
Herman Melville, I think you're referring
to. Yeah. Herman Melville start writing a story about a giant fish. So where did that come from? You were friends with him, weren't you?
I was, indeed. When I lived in Lenox, when our family lived up in Lenox in the old red farmhouse, Melville lived about 5 miles away in his homestead that he called Arrowhead. It was actually in Pittsfield. And we happened to meet quite by chance on a picnic with some mutual friends in the Berkshires. And we met and found a very immediate kinship and connection. Our writing styles were very similar. Our philosophies were nearly identical. And the way that we expressed ourselves, although Melville is much more effusive and overt, I'm much more reserved, but certainly the way that we express ourselves, one might kindly call it eloquence, is very similar as well. And so we formed a rather immediate and I might say intense friendship very quickly. This was in 1850-51. And you were asking about how he was writing a story about the whale, the white whale. I certainly can't speak for Melville in terms of how he initially came up with his tale. I mean, he had a history himself of working on whale ships.
Do you find that as you are going throughout the world that you just find inspiration like that from everything, though?
Well, certainly a writer generally, if anything strikes his fancy, will write it down for future use somehow.
Okay. Tell me a little bit more about Herman Melville and your relationship with him, because some think that relationship was more than just friendly.
Well, I think that people will gossip and they will say what they will say. Mr. Melville was a dear friend, continues to be. We did have a sort of separation after the intensity of the initial bond that we discovered in Lenox. It cooled in the sense that we both went on to other pursuits. I would not want to say anything that disrespects Mr. Melville, so I will be mum on whatever suggestions that other people may be making about our relationship that may be anything more than a close friendship and kindred of spirit. I will say that Mr. Melville was deeply kind in dedicating his masterwork to me. Moby Dick was dedicated to me, and Melville actually handed me the very first printed copy of the book, and I promptly went home to the little red cottage and read it in a single sitting. So I was very touched by his dedication, and I found the book to have some technical problems, but the spirit behind it was mighty indeed, and it was certainly his very best work.
You have the first copy of Moby Dick, and it is dedicated to you at the front of it?
Indeed.
You may want to pass that through your family generations. Because there's a lot of people down the road that would be very happy if you did that. Let's talk about the House of Seven Gables. Tell me a little bit about that story. Where did that come from?
The first stirrings of the idea were touring the house more than once with Susanna, my second cousin. Again, it is a tale about injustice, hypocrisy, and it begins during the Salem witch trials. It's a tale about a man who covets another man's land. The man who is coveting the land happens to be a very powerful magistrate during the Salem witch trials, and he accuses the landowner of witchcraft in order to see him hanged and effectively steal his land. He is successful in this, and upon the gallows, the landowner, Matthew Maule, pronounces a curse on the judge and his entire line, all of his descendants. And he says, if you take my life, God will give you blood to drink and all of your descendants. And of course, he goes through with the execution, and the judge, whose family name is Pynchon, this magistrate, Judge Pynchon, decides to build a grand family mansion on this very square of earth that he has stolen from this farmer. So he builds this enormous house with seven gables, a very ornate family mansion. And on the day that it is to be consecrated, he throws a huge party and invites the entire town to witness the consecration and to celebrate the opening of the house. Of course, when the hour comes and the party happens, the judge is nowhere to be found, and eventually they find him in his study, having choked on his own blood. This sets in motion a generational curse that proves true. Generation after generation pay the price of this injustice done to this farmer, until there comes a time in the final generation where the wrong is righted. And so it's a story about redemption and justice and penance.
This whole backdrop of the ownership of the land and the dispute of that, did something like that happen in your life or in your family's life?
Nothing specific comes to mind. It was just an invention of one of any different kind of injustices that might have been done.
Nobody makes it on their own. Who are the people that are most responsible for your success other than you?
Well, Sophia comes immediately to mind. She has been my savior throughout my life. Certainly, I was a lost soul until I found her, and meeting her changed the entire direction of my life. I was a painfully shy young man, very reclusive, and Sophia was as well. In fact, up until we met, from the age of 13 or so, she suffered from very debilitating headaches. She was called an invalid by her family and spent most of her time in her room, as did I for all those years. And so when we met, I think there was an immediate bond and recognition of that kinship of our souls in one another. It was very passionate, and it has never waned since then. And almost immediately, I found my way. We had a blissful first 3 years of marriage in the old manse in Concord. Returning to Salem, we had a very solid stretch while I worked at the Salem Custom House, and we began raising our children. And then with the enormous success of The Scarlet Letter and The House of the Seven Gables, it sort of cemented my ability to continue to write. And Sophia was instrumental in saving all of that money so that I could continue to write. And she has just been, well, I think I once wrote that she was my sole companion, and that's all the companionship that I needed.
It sounds like she needed you as much as you needed her, because I heard that these migraines, they just disappeared for no reason, well, for some reason, once the two of you came together. Is that true?
It is true. The headache, as we call it, miraculously faded. And by the time we were actually married, they were almost entirely gone. So I think that we found something in one another that whatever psychological causes that might have inhibited both of our lives to that point were sort of resolved in finding one another.
This could be one of your new titles. So there's writer and surveyor and custom officer and medicine.
I'll leave medicine to the doctors. Thank you.
Did you write something called The Celestial Railroad?
The Celestial Railroad. I did indeed. Yes.
Well, again, this is just another one of those things. How are you getting involved in the railroads?
It wasn't an actual railroad, of course. The story you're referring to is actually a satire on a very well-known book by John Bunyan called The Pilgrim's Progress. And most New Englanders are very aware of this story. It was second in popularity only to the Bible. And it's a story about a pilgrim who takes this long odyssey through forests and mountains and valleys, and he is seeking the kingdom of heaven, or what he calls the celestial city. And he is tempted all along the way by sundry scurrilous characters to depart from his path and to be tempted away from his faith. It was a very popular book. Obviously, it's a parable for the journey of faith. Well, I thought I might use Pilgrim's Progress and write a bit of a satire on it. And so it's a very similar pilgrimage, but it's made easier by the fact that instead of doing this long, arduous hike on foot, you can just hop on the railroad and get to your destination. So,
I see. Do you have a favorite piece of work that you've written?
I suppose there are tales that I have invested more of myself into than others. I think it entirely depends upon the mood I'm in at the time. If I'm in a somber mood, some of the more gloomy romances or some of the short stories that have a little more cynicism to them, I do enjoy revisiting some of the more humorous sketches as well. So it's a difficult question to answer. It's like saying which one of your children is your favorite.
When you talk about writing humor, what was something humorous that you wrote? I'm actually not familiar with any of your humorous work.
Well, certainly the story you just mentioned, for instance, it's a satire, and so it's a parody of a rather serious book. And so I think that anyone who is familiar with The Pilgrim's Progress will get a great deal of amusement out of reading The Celestial Railroad. There's a story I wrote called Mrs. Bullfrog about a man who has been a bachelor for years, and he doesn't want to get married until he finds the perfect woman. And he finally finds this angelic creature who has glossy curls in her hair and beautiful white teeth and is the most angelic personality he's ever met. And he knows her for all of 2 weeks or so, and he decides to marry her. And on the stagecoach heading towards their honeymoon, the stagecoach hits a bump in the road and is overturned. And as they're all getting out of the coach and collecting themselves, Mr. Bullfrog says, "All of a sudden, my angelic wife disappeared. And there was an ogre there, inexplicably, and there was a curly wig on the ground, and there was a set of white dentures on the sand, and this ogre, who I'd never seen before, was attacking the coach driver, and I had to help him get the coach uprighted, and as soon as I did, all of a sudden, the ogre was gone, and my beautiful angelic wife reappeared." And so, yes, I've written a great deal of humorous tales, several of them in Twice Told Tales and Mosses from an Old Manse. It never ceases to amaze me that I'm known largely as a novelist now, when a great deal of my early career was spent in writing dozens and dozens of short stories of all different ilks. And some of those humorous, satirical sketches are among my favorites.
You have written quite a few of those shorter stories compared to the longer novels. Is there one that you prefer over the other?
As a writer, you are inspired to write either long form or short form. Certainly, if the reading public desires a longer form, and this is what is commercially going to keep you going as a writer, and this is where you've achieved some more notable success, then certainly the commercial element plays into the projects that you take on.
I see. If you're not going to sell some books, you can't be a writer.
So that's correct. In fact, the fourth romance that I wrote, the one I wrote in Europe, it was called The Marble Faun. I was actually encouraged to write a story that would be long enough to fill 2 or 3 volumes. And I was criticized heavily for this because much of what we would call the extraneous detail that I put in it, lengthy descriptions of buildings or locales in order to make the story longer, because I was encouraged to do so, thinking that it might be more commercially lucrative. And then, of course, when I acquiesced and did it, I was criticized for for padding my novel.
It's just more proof that people don't actually know what they want.
And the publishers think they know what they want, and right. they think they know what the public wants.
They don't know. They're just guessing like everybody else.
Always the case.
I've spent quite a bit of time in Europe, and I know you spent some time, I think, in Rome. I feel like when I am in Italy, that all I want to do is write, because everything inspires me. Did you have an experience like that?
Well, that's where I wrote the majority of The Marble Faun, and it was all based on experiences in Rome and Florence. And when you compare it to the foggy, damp climate of England or Liverpool or even of New England, the sunny, light, joyous climate of the place is in all of Italy is deeply inspiring. And of course, all of the art that's around us. I mean, my wife, Sophia, is a gifted artist and just was in her splendor in Rome and Florence. And we loved it. We really did. It did our family good. We were tourists for 3 years and it brought our family closer together. It was a joyous time.
A while ago, this is completely going a different direction. A while ago, I had one of these conversations with a person that I was absolutely fascinated with, and I couldn't even believe that I was able to. And it was right before he was executed. And his name was John Brown. I understand that you have some feelings about John Brown.
Mr. Thoreau would never forgive me for sharing those, but I do not ascribe to Emerson and Thoreau's assessment that it was a death as venerable as the cross. I believe that the man was basically a fanatic. There were many abolitionists who believed very strongly in their cause, but did not resort to the sort of violence that John Brown did. And so I do not agree that he was a martyr of any kind.
He definitely took the violence to a high level, that's for sure.
That's true, although others might have espoused it. He was the only one that ever carried it out.
So what is the story that you haven't written yet? What's the one that's in your head that you haven't quite put it on paper yet? Either it's a different genre or it's just something that you haven't got to yet.
Well, you know, as I said, I've been struggling with several different new romance novels, three in particular, and I just can't seem to make headway on any of them because of my sadness with what is happening in the country. Curiously, two out of three of the novels that I'm currently working on, they take place in the house that I wooed my wife in, the actual house in Salem, next to the old burying ground there, where Sophia and her sisters lived. It's called the Grimshaw House, and one of the romances that I'm writing is called Dr. Grimshaw's Secret. And the other is called the Dolliver Romance, and both of those tales take place in that house. I'm not able to break through. I think it's very interesting. Today, as you said, is my 59th birthday and our country's birthday, the 4th of July. For the past 3 days, we have been involved in one of the bloodiest battles of this conflict. It's been on a battlefield called Gettysburg, and many young men on both sides have been slain and maimed. And I ask myself, I understand the plight of slavery, and I understand the vehemence behind it to eradicate it, but my question is, how can one tragedy justify another? Slavery is a tragedy, but so is this war, and it is not an easy answer. And I struggle. I struggle with it. I'm struggling with failing health, and my children are growing. And so life is more complex than it used to be.
You've mentioned what's happening with the war right now and the state of the Union right now and everything being very challenging and dark and upsetting. And I understand how your health and the problems you're having with your stomach would interfere with your writing. But considering how you are the kind of person that delves into the nature of why people do what they do and explores that deeply, it almost seems like the war and the absurdity of this might almost be inspiration to write something for you, because it is all about human nature. Every person would say, if you were to ask them about killing another person, is that wrong? Every one of them would say, yeah, I don't want to kill somebody. And yet tens, thousands of them dying every single day. And it is this absurdity, this inconsistency of human nature. It just seems like this would be inspiration. Does that make sense at all?
It does. It does. And yet all I can say is that I'm tired. I'm tired, and I don't know if I could muster a reflection on something that massive. It's a fine question and one to ponder, but I just find myself more and more tired, both physically and creatively.
Well, I have enjoyed this conversation, and as far as being tired, I hope that you find a bottle of energy somewhere and drink it, because we are very thankful for your work.
Well, I'm certainly hoping to revive my spirits here. When this sort of fatigue sets in, I generally enjoy going on some sort of a hike up in the White Mountains of New Hampshire with my dear friend Pierce. And we have been talking for quite some time about another long hike to revive both of our spirits and bodies. Hopefully the two of us will find a time to get back to the White Mountains. I've written several stories about hiking in the White Mountains. It's a beautiful place that I always find myself revived, so I certainly hope to do that sometime soon.
Thank you again for your time today.
I thank you, sir.
It couldn't be more clear how tired and worn Hawthorne is as he considers the state of our Union at war. And yet, I can't help but wonder if it was more than that. His connection to the Salem witch trials would have been a part of his life since he was young. As he aged and spent time around brilliant writers able to express their views of the world, those dark thoughts had been inside of him for a long time and were looking for a way out. And yet, instead of telling us how we should think, Hawthorne used his gift to put the facts in front of us so that we could decide on our own. Reaching the end of his greatest works didn't result in the answering of questions, but instead as the inspiration for us to ask them and wonder why we all do what we do. Why did the man wear the black veil and never remove it? It's a shame that his brief, productive periods of writing didn't last longer, especially after the war ended. Who knows what extraordinary writings may have been completed if he'd had time to digest the war and how it ended? What might he have written after exploring the only time in American history that might have been darker than his family's legacy of the Salem witch trials? Thank you for listening, and don't forget that when you tell a friend about the Calling History podcast, ghosts of overlooked historical figures will occasionally unload your dishwasher and do your laundry. I'm Tony Dean, and until next time, I'm History.